Thanks for tuning in for the July 23rd podcast. I'm Bob Gross, editor-in-chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's featured interview highlights an interview on determining clinically meaningful decline in preclinical Alzheimer's disease. For our What's Trending feature of the week, you'll hear an interview on targeting Huntington expression in patients with Huntington disease. Please remember, we offer free CME to AAN members for each eligible podcast, and we welcome your feedback at podcast@aan.com.
Hi, this is Greg Day from Washington University in St. Louis. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Philip Insull from the University of California, San Francisco. Philip is the lead author on a paper published in this week's issue of Neurology titled Determining Clinically Meaningful Decline in Preclinical Alzheimer's Disease. Philip, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Your paper explores the time course over which research participants with preclinical Alzheimer's disease decline in a clinically meaningful way, and the implications of these findings for clinical trial design and implementation, potentially even in clinical practice. Before we get into the details, could you tell us what is preclinical Alzheimer's disease and why is it important that we develop reliable methods both to detect people that have this syndrome, but also those that might allow us to include them in clinical research?
So preclinical AD in this context refers to individuals who are cognitively unimpaired, meaning that they score within what we consider a normal range on standard cognitive tests, adjusting for their level of education, but they also have a significant level of amyloid pathology as measured by cerebrospinal fluid, by lumbar puncture, or by PET imaging. I think it's particularly important to understand the course of preclinical AD because as we shift towards developing disease-modifying treatments, the consensus in the field is that the highest likelihood of successful treatment will be in the earliest stages of the disease, and preclinical AD may be the best target population for anti-amyloid therapies as they are still early in the disease process. They don't have any significant cognitive impairment, but they have a certain level of amyloid accumulation that puts them at risk for future cognitive decline.
So in a word, these are normal individuals in the clinic, but their brain's not normal when we're measuring some kind of research biomarker.
Right.
What are the major or most important findings of your study?
The main finding is that, on average, someone with preclinical AD will decline in a meaningful way within approximately 6 years. So meaningful in this case means that within 6 years, preclinical AD patients are performing at the level of someone with mild cognitive impairment, so someone who is starting to have functional problems. So again, that's on average, but there's a lot of variation in the amount of decline over 6 years, with some individuals declining substantially less or hardly at all, and some declining more. Given the magnitude and variation of the changes over 6 years, the implication for clinical trials is somewhat sobering. So the decline is so gradual and variable over the first several years that it makes it difficult to demonstrate that a drug is working, even if it actually is working. And it's not until years 3 or 4, when decline becomes more apparent, that you might be able to detect the efficacy of a treatment. And even then, the variation of decline is such that you need to enroll thousands of subjects to detect what might be considered a reasonable, if modest, treatment effect of 25 or 30% slowing of cognitive decline.
So these are important conclusions, which, as you're alluding to, obviously have some real implications for clinical trial design and implementation. And I think our listeners are going to appreciate that 6 years is a long time to wait to see if an experimental therapy can delay or prevent the onset of symptoms related to Alzheimer's disease in a clinical cohort. And knowing this and integrating the findings from your paper, what do you think needs to be done to accelerate clinical trials in this really critical, very important area? Or another way of asking the question, what can we do to speed up these trials other than, as you say, enrolling perhaps thousands of individuals and following them for more than half a decade?
Yeah, 6 years is a very long time. So I think developing more sensitive and reliable cognitive tests would be one way. But probably the main way will be to identify a biomarker that is highly correlated with cognition that could act as a proxy for cognition. I think that's the ultimate goal. However, when you intervene on something like a biological process like amyloid deposition, it seems that that's pretty complicated. it's unclear what the implications of removing amyloid deposition or slowing amyloid deposition will be, both in the short term and the long term. But I think that will be the ultimate goal. So identifying a proxy for cognitive decline so that these trials will be much shorter and require fewer subjects.
And these findings potentially have implications for how we regulate drug development, advance clinical trials, especially knowing that here in the United States, our Federal Drug Administration, they want to see meaningful clinical change, the kind of change that is conventionally primary and secondary outcomes in our current studies. You raise some really valuable points, though, about perhaps needing this proxy measure. Based on what we know now, are there any specific biomarkers that you could suggest, something that might frame that sensitive measure and might do for us in dementia what tests like hemoglobin A1C or cholesterol levels have done in the cardiovascular world?
The only biomarker I can think of for that context would be tau. So tau is much more associated with progression of cognitive symptoms, certainly much more than amyloid, but it's totally unclear how you might have an anti-tau treatment. That's in very early stage at this point.
And then we have challenges to face in how we measure tau reliably in living patients that are involved in clinical trials, don't we?
Right. So it's only recently that advances in tau imaging are starting to be validated.
Right, in an investigational context. And really important findings, I think, moving us forward to kind of the questions of next steps, things that we need to develop to build on this work. It's very clear to me a lot of work went into this study. This includes efforts from you and your colleagues to characterize these important findings, but also the immense amount of work on behalf of worldwide study teams who enrolled, assessed, imaged, and followed over 1,100 cognitively normal study participants that you've included in this project. With such a massive investment from lots of players, I think there's going to be a tendency to want to see findings from this study and others that are going to use this same data to improve clinical care here and now. With that in mind, what recommendations do you have for the practicing neurologist who might be looking to translate these important findings in what are highly characterized research participants to clinic patients who show up worried that they might have preclinical Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah, I think that's difficult, especially if there's no approved treatment. There's approved symptomatic treatment, but no approved disease-modifying treatment that you would need in a pre-symptomatic population. And it's difficult, especially as tests for amyloid positivity become more readily available. I would think the situation where people worried about their memory are going to become more and more aware of these biomarkers and want to maybe be tested, especially if they have a history in their family of Alzheimer's disease. But it's hard to know what effect it might have on someone to find out that they may have the beginnings of Alzheimer's disease, i.e. amyloid positivity, when they don't have symptoms and they may not have symptoms for many years. So the findings of this study may help a practicing neurologist explain to a patient what they might expect if they have preclinical AD, which might help them plan for the future. But the findings don't say anything about how a clinician might guide someone who's starting to worry about their memory.
And I think on this note, we can reference the appropriate use criteria for amyloid imaging or CSF Alzheimer's disease biomarkers in clinical practice. And I think there is general consensus that at this point in time, there is no role for measuring amyloid or other Alzheimer's disease biomarkers in clinically normal individuals, so those who are simply worried about their memory. What your paper highlights, though, boy, we're sure going to have a need to identify and include research participants with preclinical AD, and might be worth noting that if you are encountering patients that are worried about this, there are going to be and there are currently studies that are investigating preclinical Alzheimer's disease. And would you agree then, Philip, that it might be best to refer these interested candidates perhaps to a research study where this finding can be interpreted and used to advance our understanding of this disease as a whole?
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you, Philip, for sharing your findings with us, and thanks for taking the time to discuss this important paper. I've been speaking with Philip Insull, lead author on the paper titled Determining Clinically Meaningful Decline in Preclinical Alzheimer's Disease, which you can and should read in this week's issue of Neurology. Thank you.
Hi, this is Jeff Ratliff from Jefferson University in Philadelphia. For this week's What's Trending, I'm on the phone with Dr. Sarah Tabrizi from the Huntington's Disease Center at Queen Square in London. We're going to talk with Dr. Tabrizi about her study in the May 6th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. The article was titled, Targeting Huntington Expression in Patients with Huntington's Disease. In this study, Dr. Tabrizi and colleagues conducted a randomized placebo-controlled early phase trial of an intrathecally delivered antisense oligonucleotide against the pathogenic Huntington protein. Their outcomes were aimed at determining the levels of Huntington protein in CSF following treatment and to assess for adverse outcomes. Just a note, Sarah's joining us on her cell phone while she's on vacation in Wales. Hopefully the sound quality won't be a problem as we talk to her about this important trial. Sarah, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
So to start, we're in an era of rapidly developing genetic-based therapies for different neurologic diseases. Could you give us just a brief review of antisense oligonucleotides, how they work, and particularly this one that's geared at the Huntington's protein and why that one makes sense for this disease in particular?
This is a really exciting time for neurological diseases, particularly neurodegenerative diseases for which we have no disease-modifying therapies. Antisense oligonucleotides, I think, offer quite an exciting approach to potentially target these diseases caused by accumulation of pathogenic proteins. So antisense oligonucleotides, or ASOs for short, are simply short strings of chemically modified nucleotides, and they're specifically designed to bind to RNA and alter the production of a specific protein. And so in this program, antisense oligonucleotides were designed against mutant Huntington RNA, which is the causative protein of Huntington's disease. And that antisense molecule binds to the Huntington mRNA, and that binding results in its degradation. And that way, you lower the level of the toxic mutant Huntington protein.
And so given that, can you tell us a little bit about the outcomes of the trial with regards to the safety and tolerability of this intervention?
So the antisense oligonucleotides do not cross the blood-brain barrier, so they need to be given via an intrathecal lumbar puncture injection. And this is what our trial tested for the first time in adults with a neurodegenerative disease. And we did a randomized multiple ascending dose study, and patients were randomly assigned in a 3-to-1 to active antisense oligonucleotide or a placebo, and they received 4 intrathecal injections every 4 weeks, and then followed up for 4 months after this. So the study in total was 7 months. And as you mentioned, the primary endpoint was safety, because this was a phase 1-2 study. And what was most important about this is that no serious adverse events were seen in the ASO-treated patients, and there were no clinically relevant adverse changes in laboratory variables. So the antisense appeared both safe and well-tolerated over the 7-month period.
And in addition to that, you guys were looking at the levels of Huntington protein in the spinal fluid. What were the outcomes with regards to that in particular?
Antisense resulted in a dose-dependent reduction in the concentration of our target, mutant Huntington, in the CSF. And this was a key exploratory endpoint, but when we started the study, we didn't know whether an intrathecal lumbar puncture injection of an antisense molecule would reach the brain in adults with early Huntington's disease, because it's quite a long distance to travel, and we know that mutant Huntington in CSF comes from the brain. And so it was very encouraging that we got target engagement, where we saw a mean of 40% lowering in the higher doses of 90 milligrams and 120 milligrams of our target mutant Huntington. And in some individuals reached 60% lowering in the CSF of CSF mutant Huntington in the 120 milligram group.
So we know that this intervention is safe and well tolerated based on this study, and that it can lower the spinal fluid levels of Huntington protein. What did the trial teach us about this therapy as a means of treating the manifestations of Huntington's disease, or did it teach us anything at all in that regard?
Good question, and it's a question I have been asked a lot. This is a phase 1-2 clinical trial where the primary endpoint was safety, and we had key exploratory endpoints of measuring our target. It was a short, small study, and it wasn't designed for clinical efficacy. However, we did a post hoc exploratory analysis, which is in the supplementary data of the New England Journal manuscript, And there was a suggestion of lowering CSF mutant huntingtin may be associated with clinical improvement in some scores of United Huntington's Disease Rating Scale. So I need to emphasize, this is not evidence of efficacy, and clinical trials are now underway to determine if longer-term treatment with the ASO provides clinical benefit to patients with Huntington's disease.
So we know, based on what you just said, that the outcomes of this study don't prove efficacy on the symptoms of Huntington's. So what are those logical next steps to get this to a trial that actually can prove efficacy on Huntington's disease symptoms themselves?
So as I mentioned, clinical trials are currently underway to determine if longer-term treatment with this ASO is safe and provides clinical benefit to individuals with Huntington's disease. There are a number of studies that are ongoing. There's a long-term open-label extension in all the subjects who were enrolled in the original study. And Generation HD1 is a pivotal phase 3 study, which has arisen directly from the phase 1-2 study, which is testing two dosing regimens given by lumbar intrathecal injections versus placebo in 660 subjects worldwide with early Huntington's disease. My colleagues and I are really, we're very excited to have reached the stage where we're conducting the definitive clinical test of an agent that, if it turns out to be successful, could be the first disease-modifying treatment for Huntington's disease and for a neurodegenerative disease.
For those of us that see Huntington's patients, certainly the Huntington's patients are a big part of the story, but we also think about family members that are affected by Huntington's, both in terms of their own genetic risk when they have affected family members. I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit, but how does the development of these types of gene therapies have an impact on our decision to get genetic testing for pre-symptomatic affected family members? And is it possible that the asymptomatic carriers of the Huntington mutation could potentially be a targeted population in future trials?
Very important question. When the trial results came out last year, it was a question I was asked numerous times by patient families. And these results are very encouraging. They're the first demonstration of suppression of mutant Huntington in the CNS of patients with early Huntington's disease. But as I said to the patients and families that I look after, we don't know yet if this drug is going to slow the progression of Huntington's disease or if it will be safe taken long term. And so both of these questions are going to be answered over the next few years as the program continues, both with the open label extension and the phase 3 I mentioned. At this stage, I don't recommend that these trial results should impact on decision-making to genetically test pre-symptomatic family members. As you know, the decision to have pre-symptomatic genetic testing to find out if you've inherited the Huntington's gene from a parent who is affected is a deeply personal one and involves many different issues, including life issues and reproductive options. And so at this stage, I quite strongly advocate that people shouldn't go ahead for pre-symptomatic genetic testing if they were not otherwise going to, just based on these trial results.
This last question I was going to ask you, I think you've answered really well already about counseling families and patients differently. One thing for those of us who see patients with various neurodegenerative diseases, be it Huntington's or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, is a discussion and talking about hope for disease-modifying therapies for families and those affected by these diseases. Has the tone of those conversations that you have with your Huntington's families changed based on the research that we're talking about now or the advent of these antisense oligonucleotides for HD in particular?
You're right. It relates to the previous question, but I think this is something I think every clinic consult I have now, someone asks me about the trial results. And so I think it's great reason for hope. But I do always explain to them that this is primarily a safety study. And it was great news that it was safe in a small, short study and that we were able to lower mutant Huntington in CSF. But it is the beginning of an important path to try and find an effective disease-modifying therapy. And the phase 3 study in 660 subjects over the next 2 years, the trial runs for 24 months in individuals, but we hope to have a readout once it's completed by hopefully 2023, is we need to get that answer first to see if the administration of the ASO actually slows clinical progression of patients with symptoms of Huntington's disease. So I always say to them, Jeff, and I'm sure you do also, is that I think it's a really exciting time in Huntington's disease research. It's a dreadful disease. It devastates families and individuals. And I think more work needs to be done. But the involvement of our patients and families in the clinical trials is the way that we will find the answers and a treatment.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And thanks for that answer. I've been on the phone with Dr. Sarah Tabrizi talking about the phase 1-2 ASO trial in the New England Journal of Medicine from May 6th of this year. Sarah, thanks again for joining us, and we're really looking forward to the extended arms of this study and the other studies that are coming down the line for this intervention.
This is Bob Gross. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting paper on looking at how left frontal connectivity attenuates the adverse effect of entorhinal tau pathology on memory, and another article on treatment effects and comorbid diseases in 58 patients with visual snow. Please take a look at these and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.